Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, the host of Vermont Edition. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. In just the past few weeks and months, there have been a series of heartbreaking events, from the shooting in Lewiston, Maine, to the war in Israel and Gaza. Times like these are when many of us rely most heavily on the journalists we trust. They're reliable, empathetic, and even add some humor or lightness to their stories when the time is right. For many public radio listeners, myself included, Aisha Roscoe is one of those journalists. She's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday and the Saturday host of the podcast Up First. Today on the show, we're sharing an interview I did with Aisha a few weeks ago for Vermont Public. It was recorded in front of a sold-out crowd at the Ellie Long Music Center in Colchester. The audience's excitement for seeing Aisha in person was palpable, and I'm so excited to share our conversation with you today. Prior to her current hosting role, Aisha was an NPR White House correspondent during three presidential administrations. She spent the first decade of her career at Reuters, covering some of the biggest energy and environmental stories of the past decade. In our interview, you'll also hear Aisha share stories from her childhood in North Carolina and her college years at Howard University. We also talk about her hopes for the future of journalism. And with that, let's take a listen. Well, Aisha, I feel so lucky to be in conversation with you tonight. I have been listening to you and learning from you for years. And we have a lot of your professional accomplishments to go through tonight. But I would like to start with young Aisha. So picture with me, Aisha Roscoe, in Durham, North Carolina, a teen.
Yes.
You were the editor of your high school newspaper in Durham. And I think journalism, it actually involves a lot of things that teens would hate. You got to call people on the phone.
Yeah.
There's constant writing assignments.
Yeah.
What appealed to you about journalism as a young woman?
Well, I mean, I should point out that I was a total nerd. I didn't like have a social life. So the newspaper was my social life, okay? So it wasn't keeping me from doing fun things, because I was not a cool teen. And so I was the type of teen that, you know, did really enjoy writing, and I enjoyed history and being able to ask questions, and I enjoy like English. I was very good at school. That's what I was good at. So I didn't have much of a social life, but I was very good at school. I got all A's, and I was that sort of person. I got all the awards. So that was my thing that I enjoyed, because I was a nerd. But I really, you know, I think the thing that I loved about journalism, even then, it was like, you know, it gave me a chance to learn about other people in the school, to write about important issues. Like, our school wasn't a very, like, it was not a top high school. And actually, like, the state came in and, like, they had to do, like, an intervention because our test scores were so low. And so I actually remembered interviewing, doing a story on that and interviewing, like, some of the state team that came in to, like, help and monitor us. And I got a letter from, like, when I was a teen, one of the people that I interviewed actually sent me a letter and said, you know, thank you so much for being such a good journalist. Like, a lot of people could learn from you. I was a teenager. I still remember this. And it was so nice. You know, I could have had, like, boyfriends and stuff, but no, I got a nice letter from a state. I had a nice letter from a state administrator. That's what I got.
That's love. Well, you went on to college at Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Shout out to Howard.
HU.
And you, while you were there, you
worked at the student newspaper, The Hilltop. And for folks who don't know, this is the oldest Black collegiate newspaper in the country.
Founded by Zora Neale Hurston.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a very prestigious paper. You were a writer there. You went on to be the campus editor and then the editor-in-chief.
Yes.
And as the editor of the campus section, the real meat and potatoes of the paper, you were interviewing administrators at the school you were going to.
Yeah.
What was that like?
You know, it was, at that time, it was very nerve-wracking because Howard was a school, I love the school, and it has this legacy. But as a journalist, as you know, you have to press and ask hard questions. And we're not PR people, right? Like, we're not there to just write puff pieces. So there were times where I had to do stories and administrators didn't like the stories that we did. And there was a lot of conflict and pushback and, you know, and especially as a college student who is still, you're still getting your voice. We didn't always make the right decisions, I would say that. But like you're learning, but you also have a lot of insecurities. And then you're being pressed by people who are much older and more experienced than you. And you're trying to figure out, how do I stand my ground? Like, how do I stand firm in what I believe? And that's really what I had to do and learn so much when I was at Howard and at the Hilltop, was to learn how to stand firm in what I did believe, and to stand firm in, I'm going to report the truth. I'm a journalist. I have certain ethics. I'm going to stand by those, even if I'm getting pushback. And also, you know, being able to say that, you know, no matter what happens, I am able to say, I did this work. I'm proud of it. Like, I can stand for what I did. Because that's what you have to do as a journalist. You have to be able to say, and when I go to bed at night, I am okay with the decisions that I've made. And that's what I had to learn, you know, when I was in college.
I can imagine that interviewing college administrators would also be very good training for being in a White House press briefing, too.
Yes, because you get a lot of, you know, and going to a historically Black college like Howard, there is a legacy to uphold, and some of it would be like, why do you want to tear us down? You know the struggles that we have. Why do you want to paint us in a bad light? But something that I did come to realize is that, you know, a legacy is not something to coast on. It's something to live up to. And so it doesn't, and if you love something, you will critique it because you want it to be the best that it can be. And love is not just, you know, accepting whatever. It's pushing even institutions that you love to be the best that they can be.
Aisha, you have a new book coming out.
I do.
I see your
and
copy, dog-eared
so,
over there.
Look, I'm not trying to do a commercial, but if you want to do a pre-orders are very important. And so, yes, I got this book coming out, HBCU Made. It's all about... and it has a lot of people in it. But yes, it's a collection of essays about the importance of historically Black colleges and universities.
And when you say, like, people, is it Oprah?
Oprah Winfrey is in the book. Stacey Abrams is in the book. Branford Marsalis, mm-hmm. Roy Wood Jr. Lots of people are in the book. It's great.
I mean, so HBCU Made, a celebration of the Black college experience. It's this book of personal essays by people who went to HBCUs, yourself included. You wrote the introduction and edited this book. And in it, I want to read one quote from it that I really loved. In your introduction, you write, "At Howard, I didn't have to worry about trying to break into spaces that Black people had been shut out of. That was a relief. It allowed me to focus on what those unburdened by racism generally focus on in college, figuring out who the heck I was." That must have felt so freeing. I wonder if you could tell us more about what it felt like to be on campus there.
Yeah, you know, when I went to Howard, like, first of all, I'm from Durham, North Carolina, so D.C. was the big city. And I was really afraid, like, my family, they were like, "We don't know. Aisha's really quiet. Is she going to be able to make it in the mean streets of D.C.? But I was determined to do it. I just felt like Howard was home to me. Like, there was just something about it. And when I got there, I think that it was different for me, like, because in high school and stuff like that, there were times when I was going to school in a smaller town than Durham and Oxford, and I was, like, the first Black girl to be number one in her class. And I would have, you know, parents and all these adults, like, stopping me and saying, we're rooting for you, because it meant so much in this town that was, like, 50-50 Black and white, but where Black people were still dealing with the vestiges of Jim Crow. I mean, in 2000, they had segregated homecoming courts. In 2000, this was a town that was very much still feeling what happened with segregation and all these things. And you, as a teenager, are bearing the weight of that. These things that happened way before I was born, and that I didn't, you know, that I didn't cause, but I have to carry it. And then you feel that weight. And then you get to Howard and you see that there are all sorts of Black people who are excelling and doing amazing work, and they're all individuals. And this idea of being compared to the white people, or why are you here? Are you here just because you're Black or anything like that? That's not there. It's just, you're here to do the work, and can you do the work? And it's an incredible feeling. And I think, like, that freedom that I saw over and over from other people in the book is, like, there's a freedom to just be and to figure out how you're gonna, you know, how are you gonna live your life.
You said something that just stuck out to me, this idea that people might look at you and say, are you here just because you're Black? And that makes me think of the recent Supreme Court decision to gut affirmative action and essentially eliminate race as a factor in college admissions. And some are predicting that decision could lead to an influx of applications into HBCUs. Yes. And I wonder, from your vantage point, having graduated from one, how did the news of that decision hit for you?
Well, you know, I mean, affirmative action, like, the thing of it is, like, even, you know, people in this book, a lot of the people in this book, even though they may have went to an HBCU, a lot of them went to graduate schools that were at predominantly white institutions, and they talk about the difference. Like, some of the people in the book talk about going to a predominantly white institution and being accused of plagiarism and being accused of all these things because they felt like you, someone who looks like you, couldn't do this sort of work. But there is also the fact that HBCUs cannot educate every Black person in this country. Like, they just do not have the resources or the space to do so. And so you have to have places in predominantly white institutions and, you know, in HBCUs where Black people and people of color can feel seen, they can feel heard, they can feel respected. And they need to also be given a shot. And that's, you can look at affirmative action for some of these places as a way that people were given a shot. Yeah. They were given a shot to be able to show what they can do and what they're able to do. I mean, you look at someone like me, like, when I went to Howard University, I did go on a full ride. I, you know, like I said, I was a nerd, so I did really well. I got an academic scholarship. But there were I ended up at Reuters not because I had, like, the greatest internships. Like, everyone else at Reuters at the time when I interned, and this was my first job, was at Reuters. They were all from Harvard or Columbia or some type of Ivy League. They had all interned at every major publication, whether it was Bloomberg, the New York Times, the Washington Post. I had not been able to do that, right? Like, I had interned at the Winston-Salem Journal, and that was it. But I was in a class, a Reuters had a business reporting class, a partnership with Howard, and in that class, the teacher, who was a reporter and trainer at Reuters, saw my work and said, you do good work. I see your work. You should be able to go to Reuters. Like, you should be able to work at Reuters. And he gave me the recommendation that really got me the internship at Reuters that opened the door to my entire career. But if you had just looked on paper, I was not someone who would have gotten chosen for that internship. And I think in so many ways, sometimes when you look on paper, you can say, does this person deserve it? But I was able to do the work. Clearly, I'd have made it. But so it's like, sometimes you have to give people a shot. And sometimes you have to give people a chance to show who they can be. And I mean, that's not really an answer to a policy question, but I think that's an answer to the type of society we want to be, is you got to give people a shot. But HBCUs are amazing places and amazing institutions and need support to be able to educate the students that do come through their doors.
Let's pick it back up with Aisha talking about how her work as a White House correspondent shifted when Donald Trump became president.
It was going from I covered the last year of the Obama administration, and I covered all of the Trump administration and the first year of the Biden administration. So going from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, it was like going from, you're going on a fast train to going on like a roller coaster that maybe hasn't, passed all its inspections. And so it was a lot. Like, just from the beginning, there were so many questions about whether Trump was even going to allow the press to stay in the White House, whether he was going to move us out of the briefing area. There are press offices in the West Wing, whether he was going to get rid of that. It starts off with Sean Spicer doing that impromptu press briefing, saying it was, he had the biggest inauguration ever. And like, it just went from there. Like, it was just, every day there was something new, there was something different. I had the Twitter alerts on my phone for Trump, and, there were times where it might be 2 a.m. and he would send like 60 tweets and my phone would just be vibrating and vibrating and vibrating. I'm like, what's going on? And he's tweeting about like firemen and unions and all this stuff. I mean, just like all these retweets and stuff. So it was I think it's still hard to grasp all of the things that were happening because it was a lot.
Yeah. Did you have to change the way you did your job?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody in media had to adjust because it was a very different time. I mean, and I think in some ways it was ways that needed to be done. So, in the past, if a president said he had made a deal with some, auto plant, you could say the president says this, and you could, believe that actually was the case, or like some semblance of it. But like, when Trump was president, you really couldn't just repeat what he said because you didn't know whether it actually had happened, right? You'd have to say, the president says this but doesn't provide evidence. And I mean, I think there are a lot of cases for any president, Trump and otherwise, where you have to say that, or a lawmaker say they said this, but they said it without evidence. And so you had to, it was just a change in the dynamic and really in the framework of the way that you approach these sorts of stories.
Well, it was so wonderful to hear your voice reporting on these different administrations, providing that continuity throughout all of that change. In particular, there's this one moment that stood out for me that was from February, I think, of last year, when you got in this back and forth with President Biden's press secretary at the time, Jen Psaki, and it was over a raid that had occurred that had resulted in the death of an ISIS leader. And you were really pushing her for more information than what she was willing to give at the time. And being part of a briefing like that, I can imagine, involves a mix of preparedness and spontaneity. And I wonder if you could take us back, maybe tell us a little bit more about that moment and why you decided to press.
This was the one of the leaders of ISIS at that time had been, you know, killed in a raid by the U.S. This is during the Biden administration. And really, like, this is an example. We were on Air Force One. I think people had asked a lot of questions at that point about the raid and how things went down. And really, my question was just simple, and it was just like, well, you know, are you going to provide any evidence to back up what you're saying happened in this raid? Because I know based on NPR reporting and reporting, you know, from lots of other outlets that there have been times when the U.S. has said something has happened on a raid, and the what they say and what actually happened don't always line up. You can call it the fog of war, or you can call it any number of things. But there are times when the official story is questioned. And in this case, there were people that had died. I think his family had died. And they said that that had nothing to do with the U.S., that he blew himself up. This happens. But it was just like, are you going to provide any evidence of this? And I really didn't expect that to be a tough question. I thought it was just like, yeah, we will, or whatever we can provide that's not classified, we will. But instead, you know, she got very defensive and was just like, are you going to believe us or ISIS? And I, you know, was like, well, look, you know, it's a fact that the U.S. has not always been forthright about these issues. And that is a fact. Daniel Estrin at NPR did a years-long investigation that, you know, discovered that, you know, in the killing of another ISIS leader, that there had been civilians who were killed, one of them who lost his arm and, you know, is now severely disabled and, you know, didn't seem to have anything to do with what was going on with the, just seemed to be going on a road near where this raid was happening. And they just, you know, the U.S. killed them and severely injured someone. And said they were combatants, but provided no evidence that they were combatants. And now, based on NPR's reporting, there is reason to believe that these were not combatants. These were people who were just, you know, who were just killed and injured. And so, based on that, I'm like, no, you should provide evidence. And I think in general, like, if you have evidence to back up what you're saying, it only makes everything stronger for the U.S., for our allies, for whoever we work with, for the public to know that they can trust what the government is telling them. And like, it's not asking too much. It's just asking you to, you know, to provide evidence so people can trust you.
Hmm. Well, hearing you talk about this story and the humans at the center, the human toll of war, it brings me back to this moment that we're living through right now, and the enormous human tragedy that is going on in Israel and Palestine. And you know, I don't want to get into the politics of that situation, but I do very much want to hear what it has been like for you and your team to be reporting on this day in and day out. I mean, just reading the news is incredibly heart-wrenching right now. What is it like to be part of it in a way?
I think that with any of these moments, what I try to do is just to be an authentic witness to what is happening. And what I always, my mindset, my prayer is that I will honor everyone who I am speaking about and give them the dignity and the dignity and honor that they deserve, like with my reporting. And so I want to talk about people like I would talk about my loved ones or would want my loved ones to be spoken about if I lost them tragically. And so that's what I try to bring to every single one of these situations is like, if this was my loved one, how would I want them to be spoken about? And that's what I try to do. But it is a weight when you're covering things like this, when you're covering shootings. It is a weight, it is heavy, and it's like there's no way to compare to what people are actually going through. So all that I can do, you know, and to sit here and complain or to say, well, it's really hard, it's like, well, I'm reading the news, but I'm not living it. But I do think it's like what I can do is just try to honor. to honor the weight of it, to carry the weight of it, and to just try to convey it in the best way that I can. Mm. And that's what I try to do. Yeah. I think as a team, what I've always tried to tell everyone who I work with is, like, just because we're reporters doesn't mean we're robots. Like, and we are humans and we have feelings. And sometimes you may feel like crying, and if you need to cry, then cry. And if you need to feel something, then feel something. I don't feel like as reporters we have to put ourselves on a shelf and put our humanity on a shelf. We are human beings. I don't try to tell anyone what to think or how to live, but if something is sad, let it be sad. I am not a robot. I will feel it. And then also take time to protect yourself, to protect your well-being, because if it is hard and there are days when it's hard, then get help. Go to, you know, talk to somebody. If you need to do that, do that, because it is a weight that we carry. Like, when you're constantly dealing in things that are so negative and so dark. And so don't try to act like you are so strong and you could just take everything. No, you are a human being and you are dealing with some very dark stuff. And so take care of yourself. So that's what I tell, you know, I've cried sometimes when I'm talking about stories. I definitely have broken down. Do not lose your humanity. I feel like our humanity is what makes our reporting that much better. I think that's what makes it impactful. Do not lose who you are to talk about things like it doesn't matter. All of this stuff matters. And so bring your whole self with it. And that includes your emotions and your pain and your sadness. And so that's what I always say. But always take care of yourself. Mm. Take care of your mental health. Mm.
Amen. Mm. Whew. It's like Aisha Roscoe therapy.
No, I feel like I need to hear that. You got to do it. You got to do it.
So, Aisha, as radio journalists, in many ways, our voices are our currency. It's one of the magical things about public radio. Part of the goal is to speak into the microphone in a way that makes the listener feel like you are talking just to them. You are at their kitchen table. You are their trusted friend. And I think you are just excellent at this. I listen to you, and I trust you, and I also like you and want to go to brunch. So if you ever want to do that, you let me know. But you've also received a lot of feedback on your voice, and I am curious what it feels like to have your voice, a thing that is in many ways innate to you, be a part of the conversation at all when people talk about your work. How does that feel?
It's very weird. It's very strange. But it's, you know, until I got into public radio, like I said, before this, before I wasn't in broadcast, I was in print. And so I was, you know, I consider myself to be a writer. And so I never dealt with, in the first 10 years of my career, no one ever talked about how I talked. And so when I got to NPR, I didn't think that my voice would be anything different from anybody else. I didn't think it would stand out. I thought it was just... So when people started reacting to it, I was just like, what do you mean? Like, you know, and I am from the South. I'm a Black woman from the South. People can tell that. But my mother had told me that I had lost my Southern accent. So I was like, I don't even have a Southern accent anymore. That's what my mama told me. And so I didn't think that it would be this thing. But, you know, I always say this, I've gotten more positive feedback than negative. So, and I think that's a credit to the NPR audience. And so I should say that. And I always say that. And, you know, I mean, but people, it does get people worked up. John McWhorter did a whole podcast on my voice. Just the other week, 30 minutes with clips of my voice dissecting my dialect. And that is strange to me. I appreciated his thoughtfulness, but it is weird because it is just me. Like, it's not like I came into the situation saying, I'm going to shake things up. I'm going to sound a certain way. I just came in and I just talked like myself. And it's not something that I did intentionally. And so I appreciate and I recognize that a lot of people do not expect do not expect authority to sound like me. They don't expect to hear my voice reporting on Gaza. They don't expect to hear my voice reporting on the president or what have you. And so if my voice expands what people think of when they think of authority, then I am very happy to do that, right? Like, I'm very happy to do that.
If I remember correctly, in your introduction to HBCU Made, you talk a bit about your voice,
yes,
but in a different way.
Yeah.
About adding some,
as,
you got some
adding
advice.
Some bass to your voice.
Yeah,
and it's
you got
funny
some advice
because
about that.
Honoré Fanon Jeffers says the same thing. You got to put some bass in your voice. Basically, what they were saying was I was very timid. But I was being in this leadership position as editor-in-chief, and one of the reporters who actually went on to be very successful and like head of BuzzFeed and head of LA Times, Shawnee Hilton, she told me, but she was just a senior when I was a junior at Howard, what she said to me, she was like, you should put a little bass in your voice. And what she meant was just like stand in who you are and like have, use some authority. Like, you know what you're talking about, and don't be so scared and shy when you're talking to people and trying to lead them. Like, just stand in your authority. So put a little bass in your voice. It took time for that to happen, but I say in the book that I hope now everyone can hear me, and I think they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I love and admire the confidence, but I also want to know when the last time was that you got super nervous ahead of an interview.
I get nervous like all the
sweaty,
time.
Just freaking out.
So I want to be very clear. I get nervous all the time. So when you hear me say I stand in myself, also understand myself is scared 99% of the time. I'm very afraid. I am very anxious. And I have lots of insecurities. I get scared. You know, I get nervous coming up here. I get nervous, like, when I interview some big celebrity. I interviewed Idris Elba. I was very nervous about that.
In person?
Like, no, on Zoom. I wish it were in person. Oh, my goodness. But it was on Zoom. But, yeah, so I was, you know, I was very nervous about that. I get nervous all the time. I'm nervous about this book. I just get nervous, you know. But then, you know, I went to church and they preached about like fears and how, you know, sometimes you're afraid not just of failure, but you're afraid of success. Because then you have to, once you succeed, then you got to keep succeeding. And then people have expectations for you. And so I had to really deal with that. Like, sometimes you're afraid of succeeding because what does that mean? Now you have to prove yourself. You know, so I had to deal with that. But yeah, I'm scared all the time. If you see me out somewhere, I'm probably scared.
Let's pick it back up at the start of the audience Q&A.
Hello, my name is Shai, and it's not really a question, but I am, I know you can probably not hear it, but I'm vaguely Southern. I'm from Louisiana. I grew up on a farm in North Louisiana, and the first time myself and one of my best friends heard you on the radio, we like jammed the phone lines because we were calling each other because there was a black woman who sounded like all of our cousins on the radio, and we fight each other all the time because we're like, who are these people who hate the way she sounds? So we were like, I just want to say, and we and I talked about it for like an hour, and then to hear the John McWhorter podcast, we listened to it on the phone together.
Yes. Wow.
Because we were like, what is wrong with everybody?
Yes,
so
yes, yeah.
But we wanted to say that we love you and thank you for inspiring not just, you know, people who are much older than you like I am, but like my nieces, my nephews, my children, and my grandchildren as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Aisha, I'm John, and hi. Tell us your most embarrassing moment at NPR. Anywhere.
Yeah. I was in London, and it was like not my first overseas trip for NPR. It might have been my first overseas trip for NPR, and I was still pretty new. I think it was like in my first year, And I sometimes, you know, this is a technical thing, but like sometimes if they do the wiring wrong or the connection wrong, when you're connecting from not from a studio, you're on the road, and I was in London when this happened, you can get like a really bad feedback. So basically you'll be talking like this, and then you'll hear yourself like less than a second later screaming back in your ear. And so I'm on air, and I'm doing like Morning Edition, and it's live. And you know, everything had seemed fine, but then as soon as I said hello, I hear myself back. And then after the first question, I really start hearing myself screaming back at myself, and I'm trying to power through it. I don't recommend that. You can't really power through it if you're like hearing screaming in your ears and like as you're talking. And so I couldn't power through it, so I was sounding crazy. I couldn't answer the questions. And then I was like, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do. Let me just be quiet, and maybe they'll think the line dropped. And so so eventually they were like, okay, I think she's having some issues. And they like stopped, and we had to retake it. But I felt horrible. I was so embarrassed. You know, all these people on Twitter were like, are you okay? What's going on? Are you, you know, like, are you, like, they thought I, like, had a stroke or something. Like, it was really bad. And I just was so, you know, I was so embarrassed. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I sounded crazy. And so I had to learn, you know, I talked to different people like Michelle Martin and others. And they're like, look, if something like that happens, you have to say it because no one knows, you know, because they can't see you. They don't know what's happening. You have to say, like, some, you know, I'm getting feedback. And so that's a simple lesson. But yeah, I felt horrible in the moment. Like, I was so sad. I was just, there were tears. I was sad. Yes. Hi. Hi. Yes.
So nice to see you again. Nice to see you. Welcome back to Vermont.
Yes. Yes.
My question is, as you know, I'm a parent of a Black child living in a very predominantly white space. What is your advice for parents like me to instill in our children the value of a HBCU and what it means?
Yeah. You know what? I think that, you know, because I do think that sometimes, like, if a parent is pushing it, they may be like, you know, because when they get to be teenagers, they don't want to hear it. I got a 10-year-old who acts like he don't want to hear it. But I think that part of it is, like, I would say take them to homecomings, because, like, that's, like, if you really want to see the difference in the HBCU, the homecoming is a whole nother thing. I think that's where, and people in this book talk about, they didn't know they wanted to go, but then they went to a homecoming, and they saw the step shows, and they saw the bands, and they saw the food. Like, you get this feeling of all these generations coming together. You see the love, you see the sororities and the fraternities. It's just amazing. Like, it's hard to describe. You really have to live it. But I say take them to homecoming, because there's no party like a homecoming party. And Howard got the best homecomings. That's all I got to say.
Hello, Aisha. I'm Liz. And I'm curious. I have a two-part question. I'm curious in your perspective on artificial intelligence in relation to journalism and broadcasting. And then secondly, I don't know a lot about journalism. I'm an avid listener, but do you design the program, and how did you choose the puzzle? It's a lot of fun, and I'm just interested in how that came to be part of your weekend edition.
Well, I will start first. So I did not choose the puzzle. That was chosen. You know, the puzzle, like, came down from on high. But no, it really started at the beginning of weekend edition. They wanted to do something. The host wanted to have something different and unique, and so they came up with the puzzle. So the puzzle has been there for, you know, like 30 years. Like, it's been there a very, very long time. It's not going anywhere. Everybody loves the puzzle. And so, yeah, people will rise up about the puzzle. And I love it. And then I think there is a lot of concern about AI. I think it is really scary, because I think AI, like all these other things, have built-in bias, you know, biases by the people who create them. I mean, we see this, like, even with the AI drawings, where you ask AI to do a scientist and they show a white man. Or, you know, what does a professor look like? And they're like, oh, it looks like a white man. And so I think that you have to be very careful, and they're often not accurate. I just think that it is really scary. And I think that journalists have to be very careful about the use of AI. I'm not a scientist, and there's a lot that I don't know, but I think that it's something that has to be regarded with a lot of skepticism and concern. But you have to also be cognizant of the fact that the world is going to continue moving, so you can't just stand still. So I think you have to figure out that balance.
So your Sunday show goes on for a couple hours. What is the level of preparation that requires throughout the week? And what do you do in your downtime?
Oh, my goodness. I don't get much downtime. I have 3 kids. And then I work this job, and, you know, then I'm doing books and stuff. So I don't get much downtime. But the prep is, it's 5 days of work. So we're from Wednesday. So my work week is Wednesday through Sunday. And so we're doing a lot of, we're taping a lot of the show ahead of time. And so it takes, and it's a team, you know, we have a team of people, at least 20, 25 people that are putting this show together. So it takes a lot. Like, it takes a lot to get Saturday and Sunday out, to have 2 hours on Sunday and on Saturday. And so my prep is, I have editors, I have producers, I'm reading books, I'm watching documentaries. I got a documentary I really need to read tonight or watch tonight. I was reading a book on the airplane on the way here. So it is a lot. And then I'm trying to read articles and read up on what we're doing. But as a host, you can't know everything. So sometimes you're relying on your producers and you're relying on your editors. And a lot of times you're also just relying on all the work that you did before and just the knowledge that you've gained over the years of reporting. But it's a lot, but it's definitely a team effort.
My name's Leonora, and I grew up in Montreal in a bicultural family. My mother's from Mexico, and we would go back and forth to Mexico City as a kid, and I went to school there. I'm used to being constantly a bridge, you know, culturally, nationally, everything. So I've been in Vermont now for 23 years, and decided to become an elected official for my community. And I guess I want to ask, as a woman of color, how you handle being the bridge between having power, having a voice, and knowing that there are so many others that don't.
I always try to be cognizant that I don't speak for everyone, you know, like even people that look like me or whatever, that I always, you know, I can only speak from my experience. But I do think it's important, even in those moments where it feels like, should I say this? Like, I always try to remember, like, especially being in the White House press pool, there were times where I would be the only one who would ask about Black unemployment and say, okay, yeah, you're saying Black unemployment is the best it's ever been, but it's still double white unemployment. And I would have to ask that question. And sometimes I would think, do I want to be the one to ask that question? Why don't, you know, I got to ask the Black question. But then I'm like, well, if I don't ask it, it's not going to get asked. And so I really had to say, you know, look, if I'm going to be in this space, let me at least, you know, do something that could be worthwhile. And let me at least be a voice that they may not hear. And so even though it can feel like this added burden, like, why do I have to be the one to ask about this? Because Black people are people, and they're Americans like everybody else, and this wouldn't be acceptable for, you know, for the white population to have unemployment this high. But I felt like I would lean towards asking the question, because it's better to have the question asked than to not have it asked at all, even if it felt unfair that I had to be the one. But if I have to be the one, I'll be the one. And that's the way I kind of felt.
Hi, I'm Scarlett. I'm a high schooler in Vermont, and I'm wondering what's one of the most impactful interviews you've had and why?
So for my civil rights generation, for that series, like those interviews that I did are some of the most, the ones that I think will always stay with me. Joanne Bland was one of the youngest people that marched on Bloody Sunday in Selma. On the bridge, and you know, her going down to Selma and, you know, having her talk about what she went through will always stay with me. You know, I talked to the cousin of Emmett Till, Reverend Wheeler Parker. He's the last living witness of the kidnapping and how the white men came in that night and he thought he was going to die. Those stories will always stay with me. I also got to tell the story of my mother and my uncle and them going through what they went through in Oxford, North Carolina in 1970 and you know, marches and segregation and all of that. So those stories will always stay with me. So that's some of the work that I've done that I'm really proud of.
Hi, Aisha. I'm Allison. I teach journalism right down the road at St. Michael's College, and several students are here in the audience. Watching not only the face and the voice and the tone of journalism change a bit over the years, every time I talk with my students, I get a lot of hope about the future and the evolution of where it's going. But if you could talk with them about what you see 5 years hence, what will be the face and the voice of journalism then? You know, we'll still be rooted in the pursuit of truth, but how do you see it changing?
I will say that it's hard for me to say what journalism will look like because I couldn't have predicted where journalism is now and things that would happen now. I think that what you are seeing is, you know, I'm hoping that younger people will come up and that they will have their own ideas and that they will put their own stamp on journalism and push it to be more representative of the world around us, to push back on some of the predominant ideas that are often go unquestioned and unchecked, and that it will, that journalism will be, you know, a way of really reaching out to people who feel so disaffected right now. Now, that sounds very Pollyanna-ish, but what I think and what I hope is that each and every single one of us can just do the best we can with what we got and just try to make, you know, journalism in the world a little bit better. So if that means supporting journalism that you feel is good and worthwhile, then do that. If you are a journalist, just being the best journalist you can be, whether you're like on a stage like I am, or you're just kind of in the trenches just doing work that maybe doesn't get that attention. Because that's what I realize now, is that for many, many years, I was not on anyone's stage. I wasn't doing anything like this. No one would come in to see me, but I was doing the work. And that work that I did laid the foundation for what I do now. So it is important to just do the work to the best of your ability, and it will pay off in ways that you couldn't imagine. So that's the only thing that I can hope for journalism. So I hope it gets better. I hope it gets more representative. That's what my hope is. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you to everyone who attended Vermont Public's event with Aisha Roscoe. I hope you had as much fun as I did. And hopefully we'll be bringing you more live interviews soon. Who would you like to see interviewed in Vermont? Email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org, and maybe we can make it happen. The audio from today's show was recorded and mixed by Peter Angish. You can find a video of the full interview on our website, vermontpublic.org. Special thanks as well to Amy Zielinski and Michelle Owens. Our show is produced by Tedra Meyer, Andrea Lorien, and Daniela Fierro. And our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening. I will catch up again soon.